The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening! You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 16. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Brian Martinez, Dominic Eagle, Kisto Healy, and Seth Paul. Tonight, we'll hear stories of the death of love, unending love, unnerving love, and unknowing love. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Look at that. Just around the corner, and the cold weather is about to be warmed with the joys of love. Yes, Valentine's Day is about love shared and love spurned, and we shall hear about it in the stories ahead. Brian Martinez begins our evening with a light touch of murder to make you feel all goosey on the inside, and happy couples are being found posed in the most peculiar ways after having been killed together. But who's doing it, and why? That's the real mystery here. Without further ado, I present to you Quiver. They find victims, 23 and 24, on a park bench in Alamo Square. I say they, but really it's just one guy, wearing two coats and a leathery scream. He's freaked out so badly that whatever he's high on isn't enough to numb the shock of what he's seen. Most of the victims are discovered like this by someone who already has a fairly rocky relationship with reality, and this is all the push they need to break up with it for good. By the time I get to the scene, a few curious onlookers are leaning over the yellow tape. CSI does their paparazzi thing behind a black nylon privacy barrier. I figure I have less than 20 minutes before the first full van of vultures shows up, so I might as well get a good look before they start flapping around and pulling my attention away. The officer, working the crowd, Durant, spots me coming and wrinkles his graying eyebrows. "Hey, Harper, honeymoon over yet?" That was 6 years ago. I say, ducking under the tape. "You losing track of time out here?" "You know what I mean. The fights must have started by now. They don't play nice for long once the ring's on the finger." "Guys like Durant always want you to admit you're just as unhappy as they are. Makes them feel better about their own choices. Like there's no way someone could actually enjoy their partner's company. It's not them that's flawed, you see. It's the entire institution of marriage. The truth is, Duran, the only thing we fight about is you." I say, and he chuckles. She thinks about me that much? Absolutely. She says I should use my sidearm to put sad pricks like you out of their misery. Let me tell you, his scowl alone is worth the price of admission. Leaving Duran to his tourist wrangling, I head toward the benches at the center of the park, where all the action is going down behind the black barrier. The pop flash of a camera momentarily projects a pair of silhouettes onto its nylon screen. A split-second movie of two seated corpses leaning toward each other. You could almost convince yourself they're alive and happy and whispering sweet nothings to each other in that second. With an exhale of cold, tired breath, I walk around the barrier to get a look at what I already know. The two look to be in their mid-20s, nicely dressed, with skin and teeth denoting decent hygiene and upper-middle-class means. If I were to guess, just based on his build, I'd say the young man was a personal trainer, or at least spent a decent amount of time in the gym. The young woman has immaculate makeup and hair good enough for a movie set. Also, their hearts have been removed. Like victims 1 through 21, the two bodies have bloody caverns where their hearts used to be. The precision is far from surgical. The organs ripped out whole, same as the previous killings. The wounds would suggest a crime of passion, like the perpetrator didn't just want to remove their hearts, but needed to. This has been going on every day since the 1st of February. There's always two victims, in a location one would consider romantic, missing their hearts. Sometimes they're dating, sometimes they're married, but always they're posed in a kiss, a lean, a lover's embrace. The lab's been trying to figure out what the killer uses to dig the hearts out of their chests. It's like a knife, but the shape's wrong, rougher, and leaves behind traces of lead. On the ground, next to the young couple's feet, both of their phones lay where they've dropped. Hers has a cracked screen from the impact, but his phone's intact. "We need to get these unlocked," the CSI agent says, pulling out a handful of evidence bags. "One guess what's on them," I reply, looking over at the sun setting behind the iconic Victorian houses of San Francisco, the Painted Ladies. "It's a great view. Good enough to take a picture." By the time I get home, Amy's asleep on the couch, and the TV wants to know if she's still watching. She looks so small, curled up there under a fleece blanket, and yet her snoring's loud enough for a dock worker who just polished off a six-pack of beer and a carton of smokes. She's always been a snorer, though it embarrasses her to hear it. It's a good thing I'm such a heavy sleeper, or we'd have had separate bedrooms by now. I turn off the TV and wake her softly, taking the blanket off and guiding her from the couch to the bedroom. Her steps are small and shuffling like she's on a chain gang. "Oh, sorry I fell asleep," she says, looking up at me with eyes barely open. "I've told you so many times not to wait up for me, but you don't listen." "I know," she says. "It's part of my charm." She gets in bed, and I head to the bathroom to wash the day off. In the shower, I scrub hard and don't think about how much force it takes to break through a human chest plate. I also don't think about victims who don't struggle, who remain perfectly still with eyes open as their partners are butchered next to them. It's a good thing, too. That can really mess with a person. When I dry off and get under the covers, I discover Amy's still awake. I also discover she's very much naked. "So that's why you waited up," I say, crawling up next to her warmth. I'd be lying if I said I hadn't been thinking about it all day. "Well, Jacob, it certainly wasn't a sparkling conversation," she replies. And with that smile, it lights me up. 25 and 26 are discovered by a fisherman on Pier 7, but I quickly discover it has one of the best views of the eastern waterfront. I walk the length of the wharf, benches and ornate streetlights on either side all the way to the end. This time, Duran doesn't even look me in the eye. The two victims are two women wearing matching red scarves. Their bodies are huddled in one of the alcoves extending over the rolling ocean, arms entangled, knives facing each other. The murder scene is beautifully lit by the ring light, mounted on a stand several feet from them. I have to say, it really highlights the congealed blood in their gaping chests. As one of the CSI guys checks the railing for fingerprints he won't find, I get a call from the lab. "Good morning, Harper," Miller says. "Oh, it's a great one," I reply. "What do you got for me?" "It could be nothing, but I'll let you decide." On a whim, I carbon dated the lead recovered on one of the victims. Keep in mind that radiocarbon dating is typically only for living objects, like bone or wood. However, some lead carbonates contain atmospheric carbon dioxide that can be... Okay, I believe you. I cut him off. "Well, you may not believe this. The lead dates back to at least 1100 BC. I rub my face trying to make sense of the new information. "Aren't most metals old?" "Not exactly. A weapon manufactured in current times with modern techniques wouldn't give us results like this." This I wasn't expecting. "So you're telling me the murder weapon is an ancient artifact?" "It's hard to say exactly, but it appears so." When I'm done on Pier 7, I ask if the department can call a press conference asking people to stay away from the scenic spots, or at least not to take pictures of them, as it seems to be triggering the attacks. But I'm shot down immediately. The killings have made very few waves in the current news cycle, and the higher-ups very much want to keep it that way. Valentine's Day. I'm sure officers are posted at every romantic photo op I can think of. Foreign cinemas, outdoor patios, Stowe Lake, Moroga Stairs at Grandview Park, Golden Gate Park, Bay Bridge, both botanical gardens, and the list goes on. You name a cute picture, and I request a unit to keep tabs on it. Make the rounds from one site to another, all watching my phone for a call, but I don't get a single damn bite. Not even a false alarm, which should be good news, except it might mean my theory's wrong, and the next killing is happening somewhere else in the city. Somewhere I'm protected. It's now hard at midnight, and I'm feeling like a jackass for coming in on what was supposed to be my day off, ruining a perfectly good chance to spend time with Amy, when I think of something I missed. Before I can second-guess myself, I'm jumping into my car and pinning the gas pedal to the floor. On the way, I call for backup, but I'm told there isn't any to spare, not unless I can give them more to go on than a hunch. There's a footpath in the Presidio, less than a mile long. It runs north to south between two parts of Presidio Boulevard. It's called Lover's Lane, and it's so obvious, it makes me want to kick myself in the throat. Instead, I nearly crash into one of two stone pillars marking the entrance to the park. Leaving my car behind to enter the path on foot, it doesn't take long for the tall eucalyptus trees lining the path to swallow me up, their leaves rustling in the night breeze. With my hand close to my sidearm, I walk the path with little to see except dim streetlights every few hundred feet, their bulbs struggling against the light fog. My footsteps sound hollow on the stone underfoot, and for a while they're the only thing I hear until about 10 minutes in, when my ears perk up an odd mumbling sound in the shadows ahead. A shape becomes visible up the path, and I slow my footsteps. As I draw closer, I find it's a man wearing a long coat and a pouch on his back. He's down on his knees, hunched over what appears to be a burlap bag, laid at the center of the path. The man's old and emaciated. I want to dismiss him as homeless, tragic, yes, but a distraction from my business at Lover's Lane. "You should move along, sir," I call out. Although a lone man wouldn't be a target, he could still put himself in danger by witnessing something he shouldn't. But as I approach him, I get a glimpse of what's inside the open bag. I pull my weapon and shout at him to get down on the ground, but he doesn't look up from the collection of hearts beneath him. He continues to look down at them, one of the hearts inside still steaming in the frigid air, as he says the words that will chill me to my marrow.
You love your wife, Jacob. I have no business with you. It catches me off guard. He doesn't call me Detective Harper, like he knows me from work, or even Jake, like a friend might, but Jacob. Only Amy and my mother have ever called me Jacob, and even the tone he uses reminds me of the way Amy says it. I need you to slowly turn toward me, I say, trying to maintain control of the uneasy situation. Slowly? His face wrinkles up into a smile, like a dance. He rises easily for a man of his age, his movements strangely graceful. With my weapon trained on him, I take a few steps toward to get a better look. His features have a childlike quality, but the skin's dry and loose like it gave up years ago. He was handsome once, I can see, but now his eyes are jaundiced and his teeth rotten. Even his clothes have seen better days, though I can't tell you what decade those days fell in. Step away from the bag and put your hands on your head, I order. He listens, swaying as if moving across the dance floor. You always prefer to lead, don't you? He asks. Shut up, now turn around. His amused smile tightens. I like this game, Jacob, but I can't play for much longer. I'm afraid I still have much work to do. I said turn around. His eyes burn into me, but he listens. As fast as I can, I holster my weapon and handcuff his hands behind his back, noticing his back is large and bulky, the coat possibly hiding a hunch. I also can't help but notice overlapping scars and burn marks all over his hands and his wrists, like he spends his time sifting through campfires. It's a strange sight, but the questions will have to wait until later. I slip the long leather pouch off him and throw it into the grass, the sound of jostling metal inside telling me I've found my murder weapon. You have the right to remain silent. I start, but he cuts me off. I refuse to be silent. Silence is what allowed this world to die and fester and rot. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. I continue. Given the nature of his crimes, I expected the case to end in the discovery of some monster, if I found him at all. But his rhetoric is one I've heard 1,000 times before. You have the right to an attorney if you can't afford an attorney. One will be appointed for you. Do you understand the rights I've read to you? He's quiet for a moment, looking up into the trees. He looks almost like a typical old man, the kind who spent years in the streets or in some other filthy place. I sneak a look at the burlap bag bulging with human hearts to remind myself just what I'm dealing with. You're truly heroic, Jacob, he says. It's no wonder Amy thinks so highly of you. His words leave me feeling like I've been punched in the chest. What'd you just say? He glances at me over his shoulder. She's had many romantic offers, you know, from men younger and wealthier than you, but she remains so loyal to you. That's a rare thing, one that shouldn't be taken lightly. Do I know you? I ask. Hearing Amy's name on this killer's lips wasn't something I was prepared for, but now that it's done, I need answers. Of course not, he scoffs. Most people know of me, but no one actually knows me. Not for a long time now. The shock of what he said boils down for me to a red rage. I attempted to pull my weapon again. Instead, I spin him around and grab him by the stinking collar. Quit it with the vague answers, I growl. How do you know my wife's name? Have you been following me? He smiles impatiently, the smell of his blackened teeth invading my nose. I told you I have no business with you, Jacob, and I never lie. My patience is running thin for your game. Yeah? Well, the games are just starting. I push him to the ground where he lands hard on his side. My anger has gotten the better of me. A fall like that should break a few bones on a man his age, but he doesn't even seem to feel it. In fact, he begins to chuckle. That's enough for me. I take out my phone to call it in, something I should have done a while ago, before I become distracted by his words, but I find it isn't working. Not just the service. The phone itself won't even turn on. I smack it against my palm, hoping to see the screen blink. Problems? He asks from the ground, then laughs even harder. I feel like giving him a kick in the ribs to see if his bones do in fact break. But just then, I spot the movement of two young men walking side by side up the path. Excuse me, I call out. Please, stop right there. I need to use one of your phones. The two don't even react. It's as if I didn't even speak. Excuse me, hello? I take a step toward them, thinking maybe they're hard of hearing. But even directly in their eye line, I don't exist to them. They continue walking and talking as they pass me right by. They don't see you, Jacob. The old man calls to me. Not because they can't, because they don't care. None of them care anymore. They're 1,000 miles apart, even when they sit right next to one another. I shout one more time at the pair, nearly screaming now, but they walk around the bend and out of sight, leaving me alone again with the old man. Worse, when I turn back to look at him, I notice a pair of handcuffs lying on the ground a few feet from where he sits, hands still behind his back. My handcuffs. Let me see those hands, I say, pulling my gun. But you've already seen their work, and that's the same, don't you think? Oh, not just these past few weeks. You've seen what I do your whole life. He shrugs. Still, if it gives you pleasure to look. The old man stands, his hands free, as I shout and spit and threaten. He takes a few steps toward the leather pouch, locking eyes with me as he picks it up. If you don't put that down, I'll be forced to fire on you, I warn, gripping my gun tighter. Don't pretend like you don't want to, he says with a grin. Then he reaches into the long pouch, no matter how much I yell at him to stop, and pulls out two objects from inside. They're arrows, one gold at its head, and the other something duller, a metal I'm willing to bet is lead. He grips them under the head like knives, and I can just imagine him stabbing and shoveling his way into someone's chest. Do you know the story of this path we stand on, you and I? He asks. I'm not here for a history lesson. Now put down the weapons and get those hands back up, I reply. But he continues, undeterred. It was cut from the earth in the 18th century as a shortcut for Spanish soldiers and missionaries to walk to Mission Dolores, just south of here. But the name, Lover's Lane. Soldiers used it to reach their wives, I say, trying to get his speech over with, and his wrinkled face lights up. So you do know. You see, that's love. That's devotion. A simple walk on a hot summer's day. Not like these people now. They make me vomit with their signaling and posturing, caring more for their outward image than their lover by the side. They don't want to be happy, you understand? They want to be seen as happy. The way he talks, the way he looks into my eyes, I can't look away. I'm trying to stay aware of my surroundings, but it's like my vision is a pinhole camera that sees nothing but him. I love this city, don't you? What am I saying? Of course you do. You pretend it's the same as everywhere else, but you protect it like it's your child. He takes a step forward. I've always liked you, Jacob. You would kill your neighbors sooner than leave your wife. That's as it should be. That's true worship. Not these candies and greeting cards. As he talks, he continues to move toward me. I try to tell him to stop where he is, but my lips feel glued shut, my tongue paralyzed. He takes another step, rubbing the arrowheads with his dry fingers, and I know the only chance I have is to drop him where he stands. But my finger won't squeeze the trigger. My hands tremble as I put all my strength into them, fighting whatever's keeping them from working, begging them to move. Pull the trigger, but nothing happens. In a moment, the old man reaches me. He looks back and forth between the two arrows, gold and lead, then at me. His smile is warm and friendly, as he brings the lead arrow up, holding it above his head, and then swings down and buries it into my chest. A cold fire grips my heart, spreading out through my body. My veins are like frozen rivers, limbs numb dead. I expect my legs to give out, to collapse under me, but somehow I remain standing, staring into the old man's eyes as he pulls the arrowhead from my chest. The pain is so great I can move for a moment, gripping him by the side to steady myself. At my touch, I feel something on his back move under his coat, like he's hiding two more arms back there, and even in my pain and paralysis, I squirm at the feel of it. "You should have let me conduct my affairs," the old man says sadly. "Now your Amy has to suffer the sting of your distance, the ache of your dulled spark as she looks wantingly into your eyes and feels nothing in return. As for me, there's always next year. I still have much work to do." He lets go of me and I fall like a dead tree uprooted in a storm. I barely feel the impact of the ground on my back, just the cold that follows, seeping up into me from the frozen ground and me down into it. That and a pulsing wind on my face, like the beating of great wings lifting up, up into the black. The doctors give me blood, but the cold never leaves my heart. Amy comes to see me, crying and saying how happy she is that I pulled through. But when I look at her face, I feel nothing. They say I have PTSD and put me on a bunch of pills that do nothing. I come home 2 weeks later, and Amy's like a stranger in my house, or maybe I'm a stranger in hers. I don't know. All I can do is play the part and hope she doesn't notice. I try crying about it. I try feeling bad about myself. But my eyes stay dry. I'm told a woman out for a jog found me that night, half dead on the ground and mumbling about Spanish missionaries. From the scene, they recover my gun and my phone, both functioning perfectly and nothing else. Eventually, I track down the two young men who walked by us that night, but they say they've never seen me before, and I have no reason not to believe them. February passes, and so do the murders. There's a calendar on my desk that I now use to count down to Valentine's Day. Some people think I'm the romantic type, others that I can't stand an unfinished case, and I let them keep thinking that. The truth is, I'm counting down to a hunt, not just for that old man, but for his quiver, because if I ever get my hands on it, if I can get hold of one of those golden arrowheads in my own unfeeling fingers, I'm burying that thing right in my own dead heart. I hope you enjoyed Quiver by Brian Martinez, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. You can also see him at his website at bloodstreamcity.com. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Wow. How hard must it be out there when even the bringer of love has gone sour on the whole thing? Guess if you haven't found anybody yet, don't get your hopes up. We turn to our second story of the evening, courtesy of Dominic Eagle. We meet a man who has the perfect life, going on vacation to enjoy time with his wife. But it's possible their getaway won't be the bed of roses it seems to be, because some people just don't want to be alone on certain days. Without further ado, I present to you First Love. Valentine's Day is a time of joy for some and sorrow for others. And naturally, a person's mood on this occasion is tied to their relationship status. Singletons loathe the day, which is understandable. Personally, I'm a married man with two beautiful children. This celebration of love should spark feelings of warmth and wholeness. And yet it does not. A traumatic memory casts a weighty shadow over this cursed day. The year was 2021. My wife and I were on our honeymoon in Paris. Croissants again? Jenny laughed as I lovingly carried the breakfast plate into the room. It's France, I said, shrugging. What else are we going to eat? Something else, Ian, she said, giggling. We need to go wild. It's nice to have a break from the kids and eat something other than toast. But I want to be adventurous. What else could we have? Not just croissants every day. Come on. Gotcha, I replied. Pain au chocolat? Jenny snorted, rolling her eyes. Oh, I almost forgot, my wife cried, then slid to the side of the bed before reaching over to grab something. With eyes beaming brilliantly, she hoisted a large gift bag onto the bed. It was decorated with sparkly blue bears against a white background. I couldn't quite put my finger on it at the time, but the present evoked a heavy feeling within me. Something churned and twisted in my stomach. I didn't like the bag at all. Not at all. What have you got there? I teased, awkwardly concealing my discomfort. A present for me? Very coy, she laughed. This was awfully sweet of you, Ian. I raised an eyebrow. What do you mean, Jenny? My wife snorted. Okay, Ian, we'll play your game. Oh, I wonder what this could be. Let's open it. It'll totally be a surprise for both of us. No, Jenny, I'm being serious. I said as my wife eagerly tore into the bag. Oh, she exclaimed, shaking a box of Cadbury's chocolates in the air. I take back my sassy comment about the croissants. You brought a little bit of home to us. I awkwardly trailed off. No, Jenny, I didn't buy you that. Where'd you get that bag? My wife surveyed my face for a few seconds. Then her smile dissipated. We knew each other inside and out. She could tell that I was being serious. After so many years together, we'd become well accustomed to one another's emotions, and my paleness must have spoken for itself. This was no practical joke. But then her smile returned and she shook her head. The hotel, she said, laughing. That makes so much more sense. It was sitting outside the door. They know this is the honeymoon suite, so they must have thought to leave a present. That's so kind of them. I frowned. I don't know. This is very odd. I'm not sure that's included in the package, sweetie. And how would they know our favorite chocolate? Cadbury's is everyone's favorite chocolate. Jenny chuckled. They probably just chose the most British thing they could find. Ooh, look at this. My wife produced a purple knitted hat from the bag, eyeing it with a look of sheer glee. This is adorable, she squealed. Perfect for a wintry honeymoon. And look, purple. It matches the Cadbury bar. My stomach grew a little more unsettled. There was something very off-putting about the mystery gift bag. Plenty of hotels leave small gifts for guests, but a chocolate bar and a woolly hat? No, that was extremely odd. And above all else, the alarm bells were ringing with increased ferocity. And that only worsened as Jenny pulled out the next gift from the bag. Look, honey, my wife laughed, waving the CD around. Your favorite Tame Impala album. Though I don't know anyone who uses CDs anymore. Lonerism, the album of my youth. Grouped with the chocolate and the purple knitwear, it slotted neatly into the jigsaw, which neared completion. The sickness in my gut deepened, and I thought back to 2013, the year that I had pushed to the back of my mind. I was in my final year of college, which is a tumultuous transitional period for any child, taking exams, moving to university, leaving friends behind, and relationships. My college sweetheart, Louise. "Happy Valentine's Day," she cried, handing the gift bag to me. I remember the two of us hiding in our private spot around the back of the gym storage containers, our makeout haven, our special place. We'd spend our lunch hours sitting there, talking about life, love, and everything in between. There's nothing quite like a first love. It molds one's very sense of self. It makes a person, and it breaks a person. "What is it?" I asked, opening the bag. Louise giggled. "Just open it, Ian." I obliged. And 8 years later, standing in that hotel room with my wife, I finally remembered everything. The Blue Bear gift bag, the Cadbury's chocolate bar, the purple hat, the Tame Impala CD. "Jenny," I whispered in a measured tone, "let me go to the front desk and ask about the bag." "Yeah, this is a slightly bizarre assortment of gifts," my wife finally admitted, tucking into a croissant. "Okay, I'll wait here. Bring us up some pain au chocolat on your way back. You've made me peckish now." Heart pounding in my chest, I walked down the seemingly endless corridor to the lift. Hurriedly racing to the front desk, I reflected on my youth. I reflected on Valentine's Day 2013. "Are you okay?" Louise asked. I remember eyeing the gift bag, unintentionally crumpling it in my hands as I absentmindedly averted my girlfriend's gaze. I couldn't find the words to say what I needed to say. The hypothetical conversation that had been playing on my mind for weeks. But I summoned the courage to say the words which had long needed to escape my lips. "I think we need to break up," I said. My girlfriend didn't say anything. We sat in silence for a minute. Could have been longer. I don't know. I wanted to say something, but I was giving Louise room to breathe, room to think. And then, eventually, she spoke. "Is this about university?" she asked. "Because we can make it work, Ian." I thought about all of it. Sandy said, "I've got the promotion in the bag. I'm going to become general manager, and then I'll be able to afford a flat. And I can pay for it. We'll move in together, you'll go to university, and it'll be like a dream come true, Ian." "Louise," I started. "You promised, Ian," she screamed viciously. I sat very still, shaking a little. My girlfriend had always had a slight temper, but it's the sort of thing a person overlooks when young and infatuated. Our feelings were too powerful for me to notice the slightly unhinged elements of her personality, and I still hadn't noticed them. The anger, the obsessiveness, the recklessness. None of that even factored into my reason for breaking up with her. No, it was just that I was ready to move forward. I wanted to meet people at university, go out, have fun. Louise, on the other hand, just wanted to hole up, hibernate in a sense. She wanted the two of us to get away from everyone and everything, family and friends. It had felt that way for months, and it had frightened me. I started to pull away. My love for her had started to fade. At the age of 18, being young and foolish, I hadn't even noticed the true warning signs. I'd noticed the symptoms of the disease, but not the horror at the heart of the girl. "I know I promised things, Louise," I said, sighing. "But we were young. We're still young," Louise screamed. I jolted in fear before peering around the side of the gym container. Nobody was in the vicinity, fortunately. Or unfortunately, depending on how one views the situation. "Okay, fine," I admitted before unleashing the truth. "We're still young. You're right. And that's why I want to get out there. I want to live a little." "You can live with me," Louise stuttered, panting. "What makes you think you wouldn't be able to live with me?" I scrambled for words, sighing exasperatedly. Well, it's not that... It's just... Louise, I... why don't you say what you really mean, Ian? Louise asked, eyes burying into my very soul. You want to date around, don't you? You aren't content with one girl. A girl who would give you everything. A roof over your head, food on the table, children. I don't want all of that just yet, I cried. I'm 18, Louise. I want to be free. I want to have fun. I want to mess around. I don't want to think about houses or children. I don't want to be shut away in a house with you. And then there was the painful truth. I could see it cutting through Louise's thick skin. A simple sentence that shattered her heart into pieces. And I could easily paint myself to be a saint in this picture, but the truth couldn't be farther from that fact. I'd toyed with her emotions, led her down the garden path, only to strip the dream away. In the past, I'd gushed about the future with her, promised that we would love each other forever. But I was only a child, and children say things they don't mean, even if they think otherwise. I imagine it must have been an overwhelming pill for Louise to swallow. Heartbreak's a horrible experience, and at the age of 18, hormonal imbalances cause the entire ordeal to be twice as excruciating. However, what made it such a dangerous decision on my part was that I was breaking the heart of a girl not quite like the others. And I do not mean that in an endearing way. Louise's sobbing suddenly ceased, abruptly and unnervingly. She smiled, beaming at me with cold, unfeeling eyes. Hollow eyes that I'd never seen before. But I could tell that I was seeing her true self. A version of Louise that had been masked for a long time. "Okay, Ian," the girl whispered softly. "Have a nice life." The voice was sickly sweet, a pleasantry with a sinister undertone. I could almost feel the barbed thorn lurking beneath the surface of her words. It threatened to break free, but Louise was holding herself back, restraining herself in some primal part of myself. I could feel that. And then, without warning, her nails, like the talons of a wildcat, swooped up and slashed my face. One nail caught my pupil, and I wailed as the razor-like edge tore into my eyeball, partially blinding me for life. Shaking, I clutched my bloody, wounded face. The girl eyed me, and I froze in fear. I truly believed that her violent assault would continue, but it did not. My entire body tensed as the girl stood up. I don't know who was standing before me, but it wasn't the Louise I'd known for years. It was someone else. Something else. And though I now know I was finally looking at the real Louise, I still hadn't processed that I'd been living in a love-struck bubble for 4 years. I watched Louise stiffly walk away. A chill tickled the nape of my neck, as did the blood trickling down my cheek. The hell of being in love with someone from the age of 14 to 18. That's an experience I cannot put into words. I'm sure my words ring true for anyone who's felt love at that age. It's a visceral feeling. That person becomes intertwined with you. You're still growing and developing, and when you hurl love into the mix, the deadly concoction's created. And what I had unwittingly created was something beyond poisonous. The life was painfully slow. I watched the numbers scroll past at a snail's pace, and my heartbeat was quickening. It pounded more and more demandingly against my chest, urging me to get to the bottom of this horrifying blast of the past. "It isn't her," I tried to convince myself. "How could it be her? She doesn't know you're here, Ian. You've not spoken to her in 8 years. It's not Louise. It just isn't her." Self-talk did nothing to still my nerves. I knew it was Louise. There was nothing convincing about my insistence to the contrary. Who else would have been able to replicate the exact Valentine's Day gift from 8 years prior? I didn't wait for the lift doors to fully part. I slithered between them and half-sprinted toward the front desk, shocking a woman waiting by the front desk. She averted her gaze, and I didn't blame her. I had a deranged demeanor. The man at reception also looked unsettled by me. "May I help you, sir?" the concierge asked. I scratched my stubble anxiously. Did you leave a bag by my door? The man frowned. No, monsieur. What kind of bag was it? Oh, it was a gift bag, blue, covered in bears, I said, panting erratically. The concierge shook his head. No, Mr. Smith. All gifts are arranged by me. I was planning something for you and the lovely Mrs. Smith this evening, but not a gift bag. It must be a mix-up involving one of the other guests. The wrong room, perhaps. Would you like me to look into it? There was the answer I'd already suspected. No, I said, sweating. I'll head back to the room. I turned around, and that was when I saw something utterly horrifying. The lift doors were open. A woman stood inside. She had lifted her head to finally meet my gaze. I recognized those cold, unfeeling eyes, that twisted, thin-lipped smile. It was Louise. But as I ran towards the lift, the doors closed. Monsieur? The concierge called. Are you okay? Call the police, I cried. That woman is dangerous. The baffled hotel worker shouted something at me as I darted toward the staircase, but I couldn't hear a thing over the alarm bells in my brain. Adrenaline pumped violently through my veins, and I could feel my heartbeat in my ear canals. As I fumbled for the door handle to the hotel staircase, I realized my vision was swimming. Anxiety was wreaking havoc on my senses. Intrusive thoughts swam through my brain as I tried to imagine the nightmare that Louise was about to unleash, but even my darkest imagination could not have compared to what I would find. I stumbled through the doorway that led to the second floor, and I frantically raced down the corridor. Room 215. No, 216. 216, I repeated it to myself, finding that I could scarcely think properly. And when I reached the door to our hotel room, it was sitting ajar. Louise! I cried, barging inside. The room was dark, the curtains had been drawn, and I could hear a strange sound, a horrible sound. Sobbing, but muffled sobbing. In here, darling? A voice cooed. It was not Jenny. My legs had become rickety and untrustworthy. I found myself back in my 18-year-old body, back on that terrifying day behind the gym container, as I clutched my savage face in fear. I felt a throbbing sensation in my eye, the eye that had never been the same since that fateful day. And when I gingerly rounded the corner, I screamed in horror. Even with blurry eyesight in a dingy, unlit room, I could see enough. Jenny was tied to a chair and her mouth was hanging open. It was overflowing with blood. She screamed something unintelligible at me, and a voice giggled in an unhinged tone. I stumbled backwards, suddenly noticing the lady in the corner of the room. A shadowy, indistinguishable figure that I knew to be Louise. The demented woman slowly strolled forward and hurled something on the floor before me. Carpet illuminated by light from the corridor, I realized what was lying at my feet. A severed tongue. I emptied the contents of my stomach on the floor, and Louise cackled. Hello, sweetie, she whispered. I've missed you so much. Jenny cried and tried to say something, but her words were garbled nonsense. Hush, honey, we're talking, Louise said, tutting. What is this? I cried, standing up. What are you doing here? It's been 8 years to the day. Louise icily interrupted. But I never stopped loving you, darling. I just waited patiently for the day you'd be ready. Ready, I asked. What are you, ready to have a life with me, Ian? She whispered, giggling, ready to have a family. As she neared me, the light from the corridor illuminated her deranged, demonic face, and I hardly had a moment to process the ghoulish glint in her eye. She had already pounced at me. The two of us fell to the floor, and I found myself, yet again, apprehended by the woman's surprising strength. You settled down with her, Ian. You have a house, children, a quiet life. But you didn't want any of that with me, Louise hissed crazily. Possessed by strength I didn't know I had, I launched the terrifying woman to my right. Her back collided with an upright mirror, shattering the glass into thousands of pieces, and the lady lay sobbing on the floor. "I kept a piece of you with me," she wailed, as I rushed over to Louise. "You've always been with me. Look." As I hastily untied Jenny, I found my eyes wandering to Louise's waving arm. She was cradling something in her hand, the locket which hung around her neck. A fingernail was attached to the end of it. It was rotten and revolting. "You're still in there, Ian," she whispered, crying. "Under the nail, just as I'm still in there." She pointed at my face. "Under your skin," she groaned. Riddled with fear and disgust, I kept my eyes on the thick, well-knotted ropes that were binding Jenny to the chair. I didn't respond to the unwell woman. Eventually, untying her, I wrapped my wife's arm around my neck. We walked past Louise's injured, writhing body. But as we were a foot from the open door, I suddenly felt unnaturally strong fingers coil around my ankle. "Look at me!" Louise cried in an inhuman shriek. "Run!" I barked at my wife. But Jenny didn't listen. Bloody mouthed, she stamped furiously on the unyielding hand of my sick college sweetheart. The sick woman howled in agony, releasing my ankle. And then Jenny, driven by some primal fury, unleashed a war cry before driving the sole of her foot squarely into Louise's shocked face. My terrifying ex-girlfriend's neck snapped backwards, and she crumpled like a rag doll. Jenny, bloody-mouthed and trembling, fell onto me, and I supported her arm around my neck again. I half expected Louise to have fled by the time the concierge and the police arrived in our room, but they found her in the lightless corridor. She was rocking on her haunches and mumbling something, either unintelligible or lost in translation. Louise has been in prison for the last 3 years, but that doesn't make me feel safe. I dread Valentine's Day, as does Jenny. And we certainly don't buy surprise gifts for each other. I hope you enjoyed First Love by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DominicEagle. You may also be interested to know he's expanded into new ventures with his YouTube channel, Black Volumes. Look for it if you're brave enough. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's very talented feature author. You know, there's real tragedy in this. I mean, who can enjoy a nice Cadbury when your tongue is missing? At least the bunny wasn't involved. You don't want to know what he's capable of after hours. Kisto Healy brings us our third dip into the waters of love, of a fellow who's made one small decision on Valentine's Day that might be just the tipping point for an evening he will very much regret in the morning. If he makes it to the morning, that is. Without further ado, I present to you Cupid's Arrow. Clay woke up with a splitting headache. His vision was blurry. Did someone drug me? He groaned and tried to sit up. When he couldn't, he looked at his arms and saw that his wrists were shackled. What the hell? He traced the chain to the bedpost behind his head. It was the same on the other side. He tried to move his legs. When he couldn't, he didn't need to know or to look how they were shackled as well. Chains hidden beneath the blanket that covered him. Where the hell am I? Who did this? What's going on? Clay looked around the room. His vision was starting to clear, but the headache was relentless. He took in a flower print wallpaper and the table on which rested an elaborate dollhouse, the shelves lined with dolls and stuffies that stared at him like he was an intruder in their home. It all spoke to a little girl's bedroom. Clay wanted to scream, but he had a feeling that the only person that would hear him would be whoever chained him to this damn bed. His eyes roamed the scenery, trying to make sense of this. He looked for ideas on how to get out of it and came up empty. Minutes turned into hours, and he remained alone and confused, his head pounding. He gritted his teeth and screamed quietly between them to vent his frustration. Clay missed his wife. Sure, he and Judith had been having problems, and he was a bastard for going to the bar looking for a date last night, but it was the first time he'd done anything like that, and he remembered deciding not to go through with it. He was sitting at the bar, sipping whiskey by himself. Now he was here, strapped to a child's bed. He was missing pieces and really wanted to finish the puzzle. Judith was stressed about her job and their overall money situation, and she'd gotten so cold and passive-aggressive. It made him angry, and his anger made him distant. It was a mess. It was just life. Life dividing them. They both loved each other, at least they thought they did, hoped they did. Money caused problems for anyone, it seemed, even the people who had it. Clay tugged on his binds, and they were secure with no give. He growled. He never should have gone to that bar. It was spiteful and childish, and he was just angry. He was so angry. Now he was here. Judith knew he didn't come home, and she probably thought he was in some woman's bed. Technically, he supposed he was, but not the way she was probably thinking he was. He hated that. He hated how hurt and angry she was probably feeling. He was here, wherever the hell here was, chained like an animal, and his wife was probably throwing his things out in the lawn for the neighborhood's kids to pick through. Damn it. Finally, he heard footsteps beyond the closed door. Good or bad, someone was coming. At least maybe he'd have the chance to figure out what the hell was going on, to learn why he was even here. He didn't call out. Clay was still wary of whoever was out there. He just listened and waited. He heard the footsteps get closer and stop just outside the door. Clay held his breath and stared at the door. He could see 2 feet blocking the light under the door. His eyes moved to the doorknob as it began to turn. His chained hands curled into fists. With a pop, the door came open. A beautiful girl who looked to be in her late 20s came bounding into the room. She had her blonde hair pulled back into a ponytail, and she wore a sky-blue button-down sweater with an old-fashioned poodle skirt, knee-high socks and loafers. The sight of her just made Clay that much more confused and frightened. "What the hell's going on here?" he asked. "Who are you?" "Brought you some water," she said with a big smile that stretched between overblushed cheeks. "Sometimes the drugs dehydrate you. And boy, that can cause bad headache. I need you feeling good, sugar." "You drugged me?" She giggled and put her hand to her cherry red lips. "Of course they did, silly. I do feel bad that you don't remember me, though. We chatted quite a bit at the pub, Clay." "The bar? You were at the bar? What? Did you roofie me or something?" She set the water down on the bedside table near his cuffed hand. "Well, I sure didn't think I was going to have to, the way you danced with me and all."
"I danced with you?"
She laughed, full-on hearty laugh this time. "Honey, you danced with me. For me, it was a treat. You got some moves. I like the way you grabbed my bottom when we slow danced." Clay grabbed his temple. He shook his head. No, that didn't happen. I sat at the bar by myself, drinking whiskey." The girl chuckled. She patted his hand. "Oh, all right, I guess that was just my fantasy. But it would have been fun. I did sit next to you at the bar, though. I didn't want anything else to drink, just someone to walk me to my car because some other guy was creeping me out." Clay's eyes widened. He remembered.
Was there even a real guy you were afraid of? As real as you and I danced the night away. Now go on and drink up. The real fun's coming tonight. I'm really happy to have you as my date, Clay. You're really a fine-looking man. I can't wait to see what you're really made of. What does that even mean? What happens tonight? I have to get home. People will be looking for me. What am I doing here? My, oh my, so many questions, Clay. I like that. An inquisitive mind is a sign of intelligence. That's what my daddy used to say. You're going to be my Valentine, Clay. This is my favorite holiday. It means the world to me. She started to turn away. I don't even know your name, Clay said. The girl looked back and winked. I know. Make it through tonight, and I'll tell you. No sense telling you early if you're just going to leave me, sugar. We'll see what Cupid has to say when night falls. She strolled to the door and pulled it open. Wait, Clay called to her, causing her to stop in the doorway, one hand on the door. I have to go to the bathroom, miss. She looked back and flashed another smile. Well, go on then, she said. I put in a catheter while you were so sweetly sound asleep, my love. Don't worry, I'll take it out before 8 tonight. See you soon, Clay. Clay lifted the blanket and looked below. He realized, for the first time, that he was naked. The strange woman wasn't lying about the catheter. A long tube trailed from the head of his manhood to a bag nearby. He shuddered, tears in his eyes, and the tube turned yellow. Who is this woman? What the hell's happening? Clay had plenty of time to think. He didn't have a clock in room, but it felt like forever since the woman had brought him water and come to visit him. His headache was gone, all but gone, at least. He wondered if she meant to kill him. If he was going to die, he would want to talk to Judith one last time, to tell her how sorry he was and how much he loved her, to say he never cheated, he never did. He knew he would never get that chance, though, not unless he found a way out of this place. Whatever the crazy woman had planned for him, he had to survive it. He had to get home, even if it was just for 1 minute. When the door finally reopened, the blonde woman bounced her way in, her ponytail flopping about as she skipped across the room with a gleeful smile. Time to get ready, she said, dropping a suit wrapped in plastic onto a chair nearby. She went about taking the catheter out, and he grimaced in pain. Sorry, bud, you'll be all right, she said, patting his manhood like a puppy. Are you going to let me go? She chuckled. You're cute, Clay. I'm on this search for true love. I'm hoping you're going to be the one because you're so special, hon. What happens if I'm not the one? All the joy left the girl like it had been sucked out with an industrial vacuum. She looked like a child whose ice cream just fell on the floor. Well, then, I guess you'll just end up with the rest of the boys, and I'll have to try again next year. Clay swallowed a lump in his throat. And if I am the one? If I pass your test? The strange woman's energy and smile returned in an instant. Well, then we'll live happily ever after, of course. Clay took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Uncuff me. The girl laughed. She shook her head and wagged a finger at him, smiling all the while. Oh, honey, I've been doing this a while. That's why I said you're special, Clay. It's February 14th. I've been doing this since I was 14, and you're my 14th one. No way not to be hopeful with that kind of omen, is there? Clay didn't say anything. The woman was nuts as far as he was concerned. So if you're not going to uncuff me, how am I supposed to put on that suit? You want me to put it on, don't you? She smiled and patted his hand. I'll leave you with the key to your shackles. I'll go out and lock the door from the outside. You let yourself out and get dressed. I've got cameras in here. I'll see when you're ready. When you are, I'll come back, unlock the door, and you can leave so we can have our date night. Clay's eyes were pinned to the strange woman. And what's on the agenda for our special night? I'm sure you have some kind of plan. The woman giggled, clapped, and jumped up and down gleefully. You know I do, Sugar Plum. You're going to play Cupid on Valentine's Day. I'm a whiz with a bow, Clay. When you come out of that door, I'll be Cupid and you'll be the young lover. Clay stared intensely at her unsettling smile. If you shoot me with an arrow, it won't just make me fall in love with you, ma'am. This isn't a cartoon. I'll just hurt, bleed, die, maybe. Please, can we just eat, dance, have a proper date? Her smile widened. She laughed again and popped a lollipop in her mouth. You're so cute. I really hope you make it, Clay. I think we could be great together. Why don't we skip the Cupid stuff then and just try it? We can be together. You just have to uncuff me and give me a chance. She put manicured nails to her forehead and shook her head. And you won't run away, and I should just trust you, right? I don't think so. Boys lie, Clay. Trust me. Why do you think none of the first 13 were my happily ever after? Get dressed. If you survive Cupid's arrow, it's meant to be. But the others didn't. Did the others die? There was that cherry red smile again. The others just weren't right for me, Clay. I hope it's different with you. I really do. Before he could say anything else, she flipped a small key onto his chest and swiftly left the room, closing the door. He could hear the sounds of several locks engaging. He had no idea what he was going to do or how he was going to get out of this. It felt surreal, impossible. He couldn't understand how it was even happening. The woman was as dangerous as she was mad, and she was playing 47-card pickup. He hurried to get the key and remove his chains. Then he quickly got out of bed. He remembered that she said there were cameras in her room. Where? Maybe he could block them and give him some time to think. He'd put the suit on, despite how much he didn't want to. He wasn't going to run around naked with this crazy woman shooting arrows at him. It looked freshly dry-cleaned when he took it out of the plastic. As he worked to put it on, he noticed a hole in the fabric. Then another. And another still. His heart began to race as he realized the same suit had been worn by her Valentine dates before him. It seemed they took their arrows all right. One such hole was right over his breast. He put his palm over it and felt his thundering heartbeat. My God. She is for real. She's going to kill me. I don't even know where I am. There were no windows in the room, only rainbows, unicorns, dolls, and flowers. He felt the walls and checked under the bed. He went through the shelves and the bookcase. There were no hidden secrets that he could locate. One porcelain doll fell over on its side during his search. The eyes opened and closed with a robotic child's voice that said, I love you, followed by a warbled battery dying laughter. The only way to go was out that door, and she knew it. Would she be waiting? Was she going to shoot him with an arrow the moment he came through the door? Clay finished putting on the dead man's suit, and he swallowed hard as he stood before the door, waiting for the locks to disengage. He was trembling with the overdrive of flight or fright mode. I just want to make it back to Judith. I need to speak to her. I can't die with her thinking the worst. She needs to know how much I love her. The lock popped and whirred, clicked and jingled. Clay's shaking intensified. He grabbed the biggest doll he could find from a nearby shelf and held it out in front of himself. Nothing happened. There was silence. The door remained closed. She must have been waiting on him. Crap. Clay took a deep breath to try to steady his nerves, and he reached out to open the door. It came open quietly, and he flinched, throwing the stuffed baby up in front of himself. Nothing came. Clay stepped forward nervously and poked his head out. There was a hall to the right and a staircase leading straight down before him. There was a first floor, also to the right of the bottom step, and a front door straight ahead. He didn't know where she was hiding, but he knew she was there somewhere. Clay pressed himself against the flowery wall beside the open doorway, clutching the baby doll like it was a shield. See? He called out. Door's open and I'm not running. I'm not running away from you. If you just come out, we can be together, you and me, peacefully. It's Valentine's Day. Let's dance. There was a whir and a thock as an arrow shot by his head and stuck in the bedroom door. There was a piece of paper stuck to it. Clay swallowed hard and tore the paper free so he could look at it. It only said one word. Run. Crap. He knew he was out of options, so Clay took several breaths and rocked in place, trying to psych himself up. Then he burst from the room straight down the chairs. An arrow flew by and stuck in a wall. His eyes widened, but he didn't slow down. When he hit the front door, he thanked God that it was unlocked, and he burst through it into the night. Staying in the house felt like a trap. If he was going to survive, he wanted to be out in the open where there was space to move. That is, until he actually got outside. There was nothing but grass, dirt, and trees for miles in every direction. Where the hell am I? I could be anywhere. An arrow zipped by him and stuck in a tree before him. Clay gasped and looked back at the house. My God. He saw her on the porch, perched on the railing like a crow. She was topless and wearing what looked like an adult diaper, a quiver of arrows on her back with the strap between her bare breasts. She blew him a kiss and took aim. Clay yelped and ran for the trees. He heard the arrow hit the dirt right where he had just been standing, but this time he didn't look back. When he was in the woods, he only ran for a bit before taking cover and looking to see if she was coming. He couldn't see her anywhere. He was trembling uncontrollably. Clay wondered if he should climb or run. Which direction should I go? It all looks the same. Everything was quiet except for an owl that sounded off in the distance. Where the hell is she? I need a weapon. Then he saw her. She had circled around somehow and stood before him again. Happy Valentine's Day, sugar, she said as she raised the bow before. The arrow knocked in place. Clay gasped quietly and raised the baby doll just in time. He was holding it out before his face and wound up staring at the arrowhead protruding from its back. It stopped only inches from his eyes. Clay cried out and threw the doll in her direction before bounding off into the trees again. He heard his own feet pounding through the grass and dirt, but he didn't hear hers. How does she move so silently? I hate it. Where is she? He was so afraid she was going to pop out in front of him again that he thought he was going to die of a heart attack before she ever even had the chance to shoot him. An arrow zipped by and smacked the tree beside him, and Clay cried out. He pushed himself to run faster as more arrows came. What does she freaking have? Clay took a chance and made a sharp right, changing directions. The arrow stopped, and he wondered if maybe the move had been a good one. If he put enough distance, maybe he could find a phone or a place to hide before she could get him. But where? There doesn't seem to be anything out here. Then he saw the answer to his question and thanked God for listening. It was a house, not the one he came from, another, and it looked lived in. There were lights on and cars out front, though they looked pretty old. The only problem was the trees stopped. It was a good 100 yards between him and that house, and it was flat open grass, their yard, he supposed. Clay chewed his lip and he wondered if he could make it. He looked all around for any sign of where she was, but he heard and saw nothing but his own heartbeat and labored breathing. If I stand here too long, it won't matter, because she'll come up from behind and put an arrow in my back. Screw it. She told me to run. That's what I'm gonna do. Clay took off at a sprint, running hard toward the house. He started yelling and waving his arms as he ran, just in case the people home could hear him. Maybe then they'd help. If they were this close to her, though, did they really not know who she was, what she did? The thought crossed his mind, but what else was there for him to do? This was his only shot to survive this thing. Clay heard a thwip. Then it was like someone punched him in the back. He fell on his face in the grass with a groan. He looked up and saw the cars in the front porch of the house, only a few yards away.
No, oh no, I'm so close, please. Help, he screamed. I need help.
He heard footsteps then, the crunch of rocks coming from behind him. He knew that she wanted him to hear her coming or he wouldn't have. The game was over. His beautiful, deadly, insane Cupid came around to stand before him. She bent over and stared into his eyes, her own eyes glistening and her patented smile on her bright red lips.
You did it, she said. You made it, Clay. We can be together now.
I can't feel my legs, Clay said, tears running down his cheeks.
I know, sugar. The arrow got you in the spine, but you're alive. I don't mind you being paralyzed, baby. I'll love you just the same. Happy Valentine's Day, sweetheart.
I've been waiting so long for you.
She sat down in the grass and lifted him, cradling his crying form in her arms.
My name's Crystal. I can tell you now because I know you're not going anywhere. It's you and me now forever. This is my mama and daddy's place. Daddy's a minister. He can marry us, my love. Everything is going to be so wonderful. I'm so happy. I knew number 14 would be special. It's Valentine's magic.
Clay coughed. He looked up at her with his watery eyes.
Please, I just need to see my wife or at least talk to her. Her name is Judith. Please, I just need to tell her I'm sorry. Can I just talk to her one time? Please.
Crystal's smile fell away and she glared at him with a face of fury.
Well, you should have told me from the start you were married, mister. What kind of hussy do you take me for? I can't be with a married man.
She huffed and ripped the arrow from his back. It frightened him more that he couldn't feel it when she did.
Wait, please, he cried.
Oh, well, here's the next year. Maybe number 15 will be the Valentine I've been searching for, she said before slamming her arm down and driving the arrow into the side of his neck. Then she pulled it free with a flood of crimson rising out like a tidal wave. She dropped Clay in the grass, where he choked and bled. He watched her sigh with disappointment as she climbed the steps and knocked on the door of the house he'd been running to. As his blood ran free into the grass and dirt, Crystal's parents came out onto the porch and hugged her tightly.
Oh, not again, her mother said.
I'm sorry, baby,
her father said as he embraced her. These boys just ain't good enough for you.
As his life faded and his eyes fell closed, Clay thought,
Judith, forgive me. I'm so sorry.
I hope you enjoyed Cupid's Arrow by Kisto Healy, as performed by yours truly. If you've enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kisto-Healy. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Kisto-Healy. Be sure to get the latest from him on his social media accounts. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. There's a lesson here, folks. When threatened, chained to a bed, and chased by a maniac with a crossbow, be sure to explain you are married first. It helps deal with a lot of misunderstandings later on, and it always works. 100%. Never a problem after that. Our fourth tale, from Seth Paul, tells of obsession with beauty, of a graceful dancer, and of one night that will be memorable for everyone involved. Without further ado, I present to you Dance With Me. It had not been my intention to stare when I saw her. My car was in the street at the stoplight, and the winter snow was blowing around thick and heavy, my wipers clearing it away, my tires wishing they could be somewhere else.
But I just happened to tilt my head, and there she was. There was such a difference between the weather outside and the interior of the dance studio. Shades open, the early evening, allowing the brightly lit interior to shine out onto the street. Most places would have kept the blinds closed at this time. No, they wanted people on the sidewalk to see the dancers hard at work. She wore black. It was a simple leotard, nothing revealing, and everything at the same time. But it was not a lustful shape. No, it was beauty, elegance, refinement. As she stretched her slippered foot into the air, she showed nothing but grace, and it was striking. I'd never seen the female form in such a way before. This was a purity, something that revealed the very essence of being. She stood back on both feet again and spun, and then lay on the floor, raising one arm to the sky, the other leaning behind her. The other girls in the studio made the same movements, but though skilled, they did not capture that raw, essential feeling. I was thankful the corner of my eye caught the light turning green, for I did not wish for a honking horn to break the moment, bringing me back to earth and smashing the reverie that I'd been caught in. I went home then. My sparse apartment that I shared with a cat named Misty, a gray and orange ball that spent most of her time demanding a can of food and then licking herself clean in a corner. If eating canned tuna fish and then rubbing your tongue along your body can be considered clean. I stomped off my wet, nicey shoes at the front door, then looked through the aging refrigerator for something to eat. I found nothing special, so instead I checked the overhead shelving for a can of soup. No soup, but a cup of ramen. Microwave was broken again, so I heated water on the electric stove. They took the gas one that was previously installed away. I settled in near the TV in the other room while I waited for it to heat. I pulled up my phone and started stepping through channels on my apps. 24 hours of Scooby-Doo. Lovely. I put it on and laughed at the hijinks. I woke to the sound and a burning smell. The water had all boiled out of the pot and the stove was beginning to singe the pot itself. I quickly refilled it, promising myself not to fall asleep again before I made dinner. Not that it mattered much. It was past midnight, and I probably wouldn't sleep well the rest of the night. Finally, making my flavorless noodles, I settled in to watch old TV, and Misty hopped on my lap. I gave her a small scritch on the head. Work was just as pointless and dull as the day before. Since I was already awake, I got in earlier than usual, though all that meant was that I was there and not getting paid for showing up. I sat in the corner as people came up asking for this paper or that paper, and I would stamp some, ring up others, barely noticing when it was lunchtime, where I sat and ate something in a bag from a vending machine. I think it was a bag of cookies. I didn't care. Nothing in there made me feel less hungry. Then it came time to drive home. I realized now that this was the most alert I had felt all day, and it took me a moment to think of the reason why. But then I remembered the building with the dance studio, and I hoped that there was another class tonight. But as I drove by, the lights were off. There were no classes on a Wednesday. I came to find out. Nor were there on Fridays. But every other day, they gathered, lights visible, blinds open, doing whatever routines they were asked to perform. The first few times I simply drove by, intentionally driving slow enough so I could get a sight of the light, giving me time to watch. And she never disappointed. Every movement so full of life that it went beyond regular dance. It was transfixing, and I couldn't help but be caught up in it. But time at the light was not enough. A short distance away was a coffee shop, and I pulled in to park nearby. It offered me a chance to watch from a distance, close enough to see, but not close enough that anyone would be concerned. I didn't want them concerned. It wasn't the me trying to chase them, after all. Perhaps I just needed something beautiful in my life, and here I had found it. I began to wonder if it'd be possible to work up my nerve. She seemed so distant, untouchable.
the moon as I stood on Earth looking up. How would I introduce myself? The man who only knew her from driving by on the way home from work? The soul who sat in a coffee shop pretending to be pounding away at his phone when his gaze continued to drift across the street? No, there was no way to approach her, not in a way that made any sense. I would remain alone with just my thoughts about her to keep me company. Perhaps it would be just the best to leave things alone and go back to the routine I'd done before that fateful stop. But I found I couldn't. Against my better judgment, I continued to go to the coffee shop, wasting money on lattes I don't even like just to keep watching. How could I now turn back? It was life to me now. I could say it was like breathing air or a starving man eating, but it was more than that. This was breathing air from a mountaintop while viewing the sunrise on a dewy morning, or devouring a seasoned steak in a 7-course meal that was being covered by the house. It woke joy in me that I never knew existed, and I couldn't even thank her for it. Not without causing fear or concern, anyway. And that became my problem. I couldn't give it up. But I'd taken too long to take that next step, and now I felt like a thief in a corner drugstore, pockets too full to put anything back, but afraid to approach the door because being caught was far, far worse. Then he came in. At least, for me, he just came in. I don't know how long she'd known him. It could have been years, but I doubted it. When he came to the studio, she seemed surprised to see him, and her expression appeared to me one of a recent happy relationship, still built on enjoying the small moments, than a long-lasting one where feelings were there but less expressed. They left the studio together early, too early. Other girls were still dancing, finishing their class, but they weren't interesting to me. It was her grace that I wanted, that I needed, and she'd left too soon. I just bought my drink and sat down a scant few minutes ago, and now it tasted like chocolate mud. The mountaintop air now rose from a garbage pit, the steak was overcooked, and it turned out the house was joking and leaving me the bill. I drank another quick slurp of my coffee, but it was too wretched to finish. I threw it out, cursing the price tag as a waste, and watched them as they went down to a metered parking lot around the corner. The car wasn't as fancy as I expected it to be, but it still looked new, fresh, clean, young, and vibrant, just like the two of them. I want to believe I'm mostly normal, that I just hold down a job and do the best I can. But I thought about my apartment, Misty waiting for me, and realized that I didn't want that right now. I needed just a little more grace before I returned, and here it was, bundling off into a car ready to be driven off to who knows where. To my surprise, though, they didn't stay in the car for long. They must have just been dropping off her dance bags and some other things, and they emerged a few minutes later and walked along the sidewalk. Curious, I followed them, remotely, though they would have no idea who I was, and they would never have seen me before, found me to be invisible, another face in the crowd, until they arrived at a fancy restaurant. Clothes, they called it, like the Spice. I checked my wallet. Not the kind of place I would ever eat often, but I could probably afford it once. In my entire life, for what lay inside, it would be worth it. It was a Tuesday in winter, and to my surprise and relief, there was no wait. I could tell the maitre d' was not thrilled with my clothing, but I wasn't exactly planning to come here. It wasn't as if I had a nice suit at home waiting for me anyway. I was seated toward the back. I expected it, and I wasn't disappointed. My seat was not far from their table, so I was given my menu, and trying not to gag on the price tag at the appetizers alone, I heard her speak for the first time. It did concern me at first that I would hear her voice differently in my head, and then be disappointed by the reality, but that was not to be. She sounded exactly how I expected. It was a warm, mature voice, completely devoid of ums and uhs, cultured, refined.
And yet, she also spoke as one who's heard it all before and preferred no nonsense from those she held conversations with. I couldn't tell you the exact words as they had talked, because it was not about the words. It was the tone, the flow, the same elegance as she danced the back and forth. I was jealous, certainly, but I had to admit defeat to the man's depth and poise. He was in her league, able to verbally jostle with her, meet every riposte with a deft joke or argument, and they laughed melodically together. I could hate him for his luck and charm, but I could not fault him for his skill. I did order a steak, and it came seasoned with all the trimmings. But as I ate it, I realized even those delicious mouthfuls fell short of the quick glances I made of her. I didn't stare, both for politeness' sake, as I still felt that I should have some sense of shame. This was their private moment, after all, and I was intruding on it. I was the problem here, not them, not her. Once the steak hit my stomach, their words grew clearer in my ears, and their conversation was less of a jumble than it had been. She talked about her dancing, of course, and how close she'd been to appearing on stage. Quite frankly, I was shocked she wasn't performing regularly, or at least getting paid for her work. But no, this was still a dream, a desire, something to aim for while still making ends meet, in personal assistant work. I couldn't imagine someone like her stuck with such regular problems. He was different. Well off, from a good position at a prestigious firm, but looking to strike out on his own. He'd already split from them, and he'd burned a significant number of bridges on the way, but he had leads on clients, people he could easily scoop up. He was hurting for nothing, not even someone to share his life with. The way they talked, I assume they had been together for a short while, maybe a few months, but things were moving along at a good pace. My heart was already sinking, but the longer I sat, the lower it felt, until I was certain it had fallen beneath my chair and sat there untouched. I finished my food before them, paid with a card, and likely a decent portion of my monthly rent, and returned to my car, which was over by the coffee shop. As I sat at my steering wheel, turning the key in the ignition, and pulling out into the street, I hoped that perhaps my plan would be thwarted and that I would have no choice but to return home and back to the routine that I'd grown accustomed to. But no. As I pulled into that little parking lot, his car was still there. I found a spot, parked, but kept my engine running. I then began to hope a traffic cop would come by and I'd be forced to leave. But there's never a cop when you need one. I only waited a few minutes, and I did see them walking down the sidewalk. They got into the car, backed out, and began to go. I gave them a moment or two. Then, despite the constant screaming in the back of my mind, I slowly began to follow. I don't know how they didn't notice me. The freeway was easy, as there were so many cars in the road that nobody noticed or cared. But when they got off the exit and started winding their way through a back road, and we were only the two cars there. But then why would they have any reason to believe they were being followed? They were just having dinner together. Neither of them had any reason to be worried, and really they still didn't. Did they? I mean, here I was, my car still traveling down the road. What was my point exactly? What was I trying to accomplish? Why did I think I had any right to their happiness together? I had a cat at home that was wondering where its dinner was. It would probably be doing something to my rug if I didn't go home soon, but still my car drove on. The car eventually pulled off into a private drive, and of course I passed on, driving on through this wooded area where there were a few houses and even fewer cars. I drove to another driveway, turned around, and headed back. I almost missed the private drive on the way back, but I was going slow enough that I didn't spin out on the road. I turned off my headlights, using only my running lights to guide me through the dark and overbearing woods. The driveway was gravel at first, but then it turned to dirt, and it wove quite a ways until it came out at a large two-story house set far back into the woods on a large lot. I stopped the car before it exited the woods proper. Ahead, I could see their car turned off and the lights on in the front room. The angle was enough that they would not have been able to see me unless they were outside. I got out, going over to their car, and tried to see into the house. I cautiously looked around for a security system sign, or tripwires or cameras, but saw nothing. Strange, but at the same time, I didn't see much need for one either. As beautiful and well-appointed as this place was, it was too remote. Too much trouble for most thieves unless they were really, really interested. They must have really believed there was no one out there, though, since none of the windows had the blinds shut. The man was casually standing at the living room window looking out into the darkness beyond, a cigarette as yet unlit in his fingers. He wasn't looking at me, but somewhere off to one side. He called to her, and she came up behind him. She still wore the same outfit she'd had on at the dinner, but it seemed somehow less attached, as if she was ready to remove it and begin to engage in any number of activities that required no outfit at all. He pointed out into the woods, high up into the trees, and both she and I followed his finger to the leaves, where it looked as though an owl had perched, the twigs bending from its silent weight. She appeared to take it all in stride, as if an owl was nothing she needed to worry about, and gently glided him back over to the couch. There he seemed to get the hint, and began to loosen his tie, kicking off his shoes. She, too, undid a portion of the top of her dress, a long, thin ribbon of cloth, and she leaned over to him with a smile, taking the cloth and gently draping it over his face, then catching it under his chin and lifting his face upward toward hers. I could hear him laughing, her laughing. Could almost hear it through the glass window, even though I was at least 80 feet away. What I did not hear was the ice pick she removed from behind her dress and slammed into his exposed throat. I did see his feet, now socked with no shoes, kicking and fluttering as he gurgled, but then she brought it down several more times, first in his mouth, then his heart, then several times in his center mass. It was not a particularly large man, certainly larger than her, but it had been so quick, so sudden, so unexpected, that he offered no resistance, and by the time he would have even thought to react, he was likely already dead. Her features, though, were not twisted in hate or anger or anything of the sort. Instead, she seemed to be at peace, admiring his corpse with the eye of an artist, ensuring his latest sculpture was turning out the way he wanted. She posed him a little more neatly on the couch, then ran her hand through some of the blood pooling by his neck. Very carefully, she dabbed it, like paint, on her forearms and cheeks, then carefully removed her dress, revealing the dance outfit she still had underneath. Checking herself in a nearby mirror, she then stretched, lifted her legs, and began to dance. It was so similar to the performance in the studio, the way she twirled so effortlessly, the balance, the grace, the sheer beauty of it. The body cooling on the couch was momentarily forgotten by me as I watched her spin, putting on a performance she expected nobody to be watching. Just a dance, just for her. I waited for her to slow and finish. Then she sat on the floor, the low window sill, allowing me to see her sit, exhausted. I stayed a few more minutes. She had not moved after I stood, and went back to my car, carefully opening the door, keeping my lights off. It was back in the woods, far enough that I doubt she heard it start, or if she did, she didn't care, for I slowly edged my way backward into the woods until I could safely turn around. I didn't call the police. I didn't even know how to begin. Surely me following them would have been suspicious enough, but what I had done was certainly nowhere near as awful a crime as murder. But still, I didn't call them. I resumed my stops at the coffee shop and watched as she continued to come into her studio down the street,
The rest of the women there completely oblivious to her behind-the-scenes activities. And now the dullness of winter is passing, and it's entering the warming, wet days of spring. As I sit in my chair, drinking my coffee, she's taken it upon herself to start coming in and buying a drink before heading out back home. I still don't know if that was her house or his. I haven't followed her since, at least not from the studio. I know she'll return, and when she does, I'll go up and I'll formally have the courage to ask her if she'd like to share a drink with me. At home, I have a broken microwave and an angry cat. At work, I have an endless slog. But I will ask her, for with her, I may have yet one excellent dance, and then, maybe, I can join her in something beautiful. Who could ask for more? I hope you enjoyed Dance With Me by Seth Paul, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Seth-Paul. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/SETH-PAUL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And more than that, a thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me tonight for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep. If you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschen. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's OTIS@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me.
You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?